Yoakum and Hearn is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute Hearn by injecting him with a massive dose of a drug made to save lives. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the official killing in Texas, the state that has carried out more than a third of all U.S. executions in the modern era. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley and Larry Douglas, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Glory Rubick, Houston Vigil reporter Jennifer Simmons, and special guest Raymond Bonner, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter and author of the book Anatomy of Injustice, who will speak to us live from London. The Execution Watch begins.
And a good Wednesday evening to you all. I'm glad to have you tune in Execution Watch. This is the show that we do not enjoy doing it, but we do it because we think there is a need for doing it. In the studio with me is Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, and that wonderful voice of Larry Douglas, who is, all of those folks are attorneys, and we will forgive them for that. We expect to hear from Gloria Rubick outside of the death chamber in Huntsville, and we have a new reporter from the Vigil, and that will be Jennifer Simmons, who will be calling in shortly after we talk to Gloria. And so let's get on with it. Gloria, you're on the air.
Hi, Ray. Well, we're here in Huntsville. The Supreme Court has turned down all appeals, and there's, I don't know, a couple of dozen people out here, including several members of Yoakum on Hearn's family. And we're waiting for somebody to cross the street. His attorney, Dick Burr, is actually standing out here with us. And I guess, you know, I just want to say to the guys on death row that what an incredible day this has been. I was at death row this morning when, I guess about 9:45, there was a number of his family members out front waiting. You know, they have to go in only two at a time.
Yeah.
And here they go. They're crossing the street. Okay. Damn. I must have missed the media because this looks like his family crossing the street. But anyway, two women that were part of the family got into an argument before they went in, and they called all these guards out there. Oh, my God. These guards were running out with grins on their faces like they were going to a lynching. And then they arrested the two women, put them in jail. And the other family members who had nothing to do with the argument were not allowed to visit. So this man was denied his last visit by these inhumane, torturous people that run the Polensky unit. And I think that is just so awful that they wouldn't allow him to tell people goodbye.
Well, we're very glad that you gave us that horrible information, but we needed to hear that, even though we don't want to hear it. But
right.
Thank you for bringing it. The other thing that I'm concerned about, apparently going to a single drug protocol has not even put a hitch in the come along.
No, it hasn't. And I've had several reporters ask me about that, and I've been told this actually may be a less painful way to die. But, you know, to me, the issue isn't the drug or the electric chair or the noose or whatever, the gas chamber. The issue is that they just need to get out of the damn business of killing people.
You're absolutely right, Gloria. Keep an eye on things and give us a call back as soon as something happens.
Okay, I will. Okay. All right.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. And that was Gloria Rubick. And Gloria Rubick is the erstwhile... How do I, will you take care of this in there? I can't do it in here. I can't drop Gloria. There you go. Thank you. Gloria's our erstwhile dependable reporter. She's actually been to baseball games in Dallas this week and sent one of my co-hosts a card. Yes, Elizabeth.
Oh, Ray, I just wanted to say something about the drug, the pentobarbital, that's being used. It's actually used mostly by veterinarians to put down animals. And I've read different opinions about whether it's humane. I know one expert said that it really has not been used a lot in humans.
Yeah, and I don't want dogs to suffer, so it's remains to be seen. I'm just surprised that there wasn't some kind of hitch in the come along with that. Okay, I'm going to go from here to Jennifer. Are you there?
Yes, I am, Ray.
Well, welcome to the show. Is this the first time you've been on with us?
Thank you.
Where are you?
Well, I'm sitting here at the corner of Woodhead in Alabama, in the middle of Montrose, in front of the St. Episcopal Church with quite a few other very wonderful people.
Great. Are they from one or multiple organizations?
Well, we have a lot of TCADP members here, but there are also some people here I've never seen before. We have a director of St. Stephen's Church here joining us, and it's nice to see her here, because we're standing in front of her church. And we also have a minister in the Methodist Church who is here as well, and they have their ecclesiastical collars on, so they kind of lend us some moral, some religious authority here. But there are also other people from other organizations as well. So we have all kinds of people here. And people, I would say.
How long have you been attending these things?
I became aware of TCADP a little over 2 years ago at one of their recruiting tables, and I have always been against the death penalty. I've always been horrified by that idea, even as a child. And a couple of years ago, when I learned about the organization, I decided it was time to step forward and make my opinions known publicly and get involved. And so about 2 years, and so I've been to the jewels that we have had here in Houston for the past 2.5 years.
Well, give the other vigilants our regards.
Okay.
The report from Huntsville is that the witnesses have crossed the road.
Yes.
And so that's bad news, but
okay.
We'll continue. And either Elizabeth or we will call you back and give you updating with as things progress. Thank you. And so that was Jennifer Simmons, and she's on that. Well, this is the part of the show where we tell you what happened. And I have Susan and Jim and Larry in the room. I suppose, Susan, you're going to take the lead on this one?
Yes, Ray. Okay. What happens is this case happens in Dallas, Texas. There are Yokomon Hearn, who goes as Yogi Hearn. Mr. Hearn and three other people essentially were driving around Dallas, Texas, looking for somebody to rob. Yogi Hearn sort of came up with a plan to rob a man. Essentially, the plan was to rob him of his car because he was at a car wash. He was at a self-service car wash where you put the coins in and wash your car. The victim, Frank Mazzere, had gone to a restaurant, watched a sports game, and was on his way home and decided to stop and wash his car. So what happened is the four of them came to the car wash. They abducted him at gunpoint. They had a number of guns. They had two shotguns, a Tech 9, and a pistol, a .22 caliber pistol. They abducted Mr. Mazzere. They drove him. They forced him into a car. They took him to a remote location. The two other people, the person who drove Mr. Mazzere was Yogi Hearn. Yogi Hearn and Devlin Dials drove Mr. Mazzere to a remote location. The two other people, which was a female, Teresa Shirley, and another man named Dwight Burley, they followed in another car. So Mr. Mazzere was taken to a remote location, and essentially he was shot 10 times. Yogi Hearn shot him in the head 6 times, and Devlin Dials shot him in the head 4 times. So then they drove off in his car. Essentially the next day, Yogi Yogi Kern had, the car was abandoned at a shopping center, and so they found Mr. Mazzeri's car abandoned at a shopping center. Police found it, and Mr. Mazzeri's body was found in an industrial area the next morning. So essentially, that's what happened. What ended up happening was Yogi Kern got the death penalty on the case. Devlin Dials pled for a life sentence, and the two other people involved got 10 years on aggravated robbery.
The interesting thing is apparently it wasn't too remote of an area because a city employee checking a line or utility
found the
employee
body.
Found the body pretty quickly.
Yes.
And not well thought out. It was a horrible case. And Jim, how did the trial go?
Larry, I want Larry to discuss
okay,
that.
Okay, Larry.
Larry and I talked about this normally shouldn't be a death penalty case. I think Larry was prepared to talk about that.
Yeah, the things that really concerned me about the case were the
Wait a minute, Larry, we're not getting a microphone. And so move Susan's microphone over. I don't want to miss that great voice.
Okay.
That's much better.
The thing that concerned me most about the case, in addition to the speed at which he was given the death sentence, was the fact that at trial, as you know, at the punishment phase, the real issue is life or death.
Yeah.
And the issue of future dangerousness, the DA can introduce all kinds of evidence of prior bad acts. And so at the trial, on the punishment phase,
to keep using the one you're using until the other one gets
okay.
He's testing.
He'd never been convicted of a crime before. Mr. Hearn had not.
Really?
So because he had not had any convictions, the DA is permitted to use prior bad acts even though they did not result in convictions. So some of the prior bad acts were things that he had been involved in. Now, we don't know what the extent of his involvement was, but things like involved in burglaries, four habitations, arson, aggravated robbery, aggravated assaults, sexual assault, terroristic threat, combined with unlawful carrying a weapon, criminal trespass to steal a bicycle, and a schoolyard assault over another bicycle. So we're saying a 19-year-old kid, young man,
yeah,
they're going back to schoolyard assaults.
Back to school.
When this was, we don't know.
What's the line on closing off juvenile stuff, or is that open in the punishment phase?
In a death penalty case, they say that since their issue is future dangers, they don't have a line drawn.
Well, then the lesson for me to tell you is don't get into any quarrels in the crib.
I'll tell you how bad it is, Ray. Now, we've had cases where in Dallas there was a guy no-billed on a murder case. And he later got in trouble, and they introduced evidence of that no-billed along with photographs of the murder case. And he'd been no-billed. We had a case out of the Beaumont Court of Appeals where a guy was accused of assaulting a woman, and he had earlier been acquitted of assaulting a woman in Louisiana, and they brought her over, and she's able to testify to trial. He'd been acquitted of a case, and one person had been no-billed, but that evidence came in. And when you have a death penalty case, the rationale is that anything that helps a juror makes a decision, they'll introduce that into evidence, and the juvenile records won't block that. Because, and again, what Laird said, it's interesting about when you read these opinions, they said that he was involved in it, which means to me he was never charged with any other offense. And being involved could be as easy as somebody gossiping, claiming
sure.
that he did it. We have no earthly
idea. You have
idea.
No idea how to sort
no,
that out.
No.
Well, do you think, and it's also reading tea leaves to try to estimate what's in the jury's mind, but do you suspect that the crime itself was so ugly?
Here's what I think it was, and we can't escape this. You can't help this. This was back 1998 when people were more readily seeking the death penalty. You also have a problem with four young kids, and I'm assuming they're all African-Americans, he was, and they kill a white guy who's a college graduate and a stockbroker. And in Dallas County, that by itself may be sufficient. Back in that day, that was before they had this enlightened DA that worked in Dallas County. But I think the fact that you had a
group... This was Henry Wade's crew.
Right. So I think back in that day, you can probably pretty well assume that the four kids were all African Americans. And they were loaded with, you know, some guns that terrorized people. And they kill a recent college graduate who's a stockbroker and went to A&M. So you got black on white crime. I'm sure that was a major factor, plus the number of shots, plus, and this is, again, you got to realize you got a brain that's 19 years old. He also was bragging about doming a guy, and doming means something. He shot somebody in the head. And so, when he shot him with the Tech 9, I don't know if you're familiar with the Tech 9, it's kind of like a machine gun. You can shoot 9 rounds in about 2 seconds.
Mercy.
Real fast. It's basically a machine gun. And so he shot him 9, and so he got shot 10 times, and you know, 6 of them came from Hearn, and 4 of them came from the other guy who got a life sentence. And by the way, he did not get a life sentence, and they didn't offer him a plea deal until after Hearn's trial. And, I think that black on white was a major factor. I think the prosecutor's major factor. Because I want Larry, if you don't mind, to talk a bit about Larry. But you've always talked about this a lot, about the prosecution having all this discretion. Would you mind commenting? Larry and I talked about that earlier.
Yeah, there was one news article where the prosecutor, Mr. January, the lead prosecutor in the case, gave his opinion that, you know, it's sometimes hard to know when a case is a death penalty case. But after a while, you get to know. So this is just his feeling. Yeah. And his feeling is that this case screamed for the death penalty. Now, the decision is, do you put him to death or do you put him in prison?
Yeah.
He'd never been to prison before. So nobody has a clue as to how he'd act in prison and whether he'd be a future dangerousness to anybody. That issue.
In prison or out.
In prison or out. But even if he'd gotten a life sentence, he might have been a model prisoner. Who knows? But the evidence that was introduced and it really, really boiled down to, I believe, just a societal vengeance. You know, one person's killed, so somebody's got to be killed. And just as between the prosecutor could easily.
Well, the guy with 6 shots instead of the guy with 4 shots.
He could have sought the death penalty on both if he'd wanted to. And I have no idea whether he could have gotten it, but he very well might have gotten it on 2. It's just a matter of the prosecutor has the discretion, the sole discretion, to determine who do I want to kill through the state's efforts, through the state's action, and who do I not want to kill. So that's a tremendous amount of discretion to have a prosecutor have. But this prosecutor decided that this one defendant, Yokerman, was the one who ought to die.
If this case happened today, Jim, you don't think it would be a death case?
No. And as a matter of fact, when Larry was talking, I was thinking, what's the difference in this and any other robbery murder? Other than the number of shots in black on white. That's the only difference.
Well, the gun's scary.
Well, other than that. But, you know, if this is the standard for seeking the death penalty, every robbery murder should get the death penalty. We use this as a standard because the only difference is scary gun, number of shots, black on white.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's, and I hate to say the word, but it's kind of a typical robbery murder. And what's even more shocking about this being a death penalty case, you and I both know when we have these shows, the guys that are executed have been in and out of prison, in and out of prison, often on parole. This guy was 19 years old, had never apparently been arrested.
Yeah.
And that's what's kind of surprising about it. Because normally, remember Larry O'Brien, they had a big problem when he killed his child years ago.
Sure.
And he had absolutely no convictions. And what happened, they said you could take the facts of the case and project that to future dangerousness. Of course, in this case, they had a bunch of things by innuendo that he had done, never been charged with, but innuendo that he'd been involved in. And as Larry said,
I find that very alarming.
It's extremely alarming. It should be alarming. Because the problem is, you have absolutely, is especially a defense lawyer, how do you attack when somebody's being convicted by innuendo? Now, theoretically, they tell the jury before they can consider the extraneous bad acts, they got to believe beyond a reasonable doubt they're true. But generally, all you have to do in some counties, introduce the bad act, and they're going to automatically believe it. I think it's real scary. Because if this is the standard for death penalties, every robbery murder should be a death penalty case.
But on the other issue of punishment, the defense issue is mitigation.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, during the appellate process or the writ process, some evidence came out about Yokerman's upbringing. But I don't find that any of that was brought out at trial.
Okay, do you think that the trial lawyers were competent?
That was a big flap. In fact, the Supreme Court just today, when they denied the stay, the big issue on they denied the stay on was the fact they're claiming that his lawyers were ineffective for not getting a Penry issue. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. And his particular background, his mother, I think, was 15 or 16 when he was born, just a child herself, mm-hmm. and was raised by different maternal aunts, and her mother was an alcoholic. In fact, he was born with some alcoholic problem as an infant. He'd been pretty much abused. His mother apparently was kind of a wacko in and out of, you know, psychiatric deals. She was a real problem, and his daddy was in and out of trouble. And he had the perfect background for what we call a Penry issue. What that basically means, somebody, because of their tragic background, are not death worthy. We should cut them some slack, because you cannot expect somebody raised in River Oaks to be held as accountable for some kiddo that's been raised on the streets and been battered by his parents. I mean, what do you expect when you have some kiddo like that? And so we have this Penry issue. It's called a mitigating evidence. And a Penry issue apparently was not submitted during trial, during the direct appeal. And ironically, they attacked the lawyer for being ineffective, not because he didn't present mitigating evidence. They attacked him because he wasn't certified to try death penalty cases, because they have these program where you can be certified, and they have a bunch of judges saying these people are certified to try death penalty cases, and those are not.
If you're very generous with campaign contributions, you get certified.
And he wasn't certified, and that's all they argued about on direct appeal. They went through two different writs, and at no time during the two different writs did they ever argue that the lawyers were ineffective for not presenting mitigating evidence until this third writ, in which they filed in the Supreme Court claiming the lawyer should have brought up the Penry issue. But that's what was just denied by the full Supreme Court today.
The full court?
It went to Scalia. He referred it to the full court. The full court agreed they shouldn't grant a stay, and so they did not grant a stay. And that's the only time that's been brought up. One direct appeal was not brought up. Two different writs it was not brought up, and it wasn't brought up till the third writ that the lawyers were ineffective.
Well, does this speak to the competence of the appellate lawyers?
Well, here's the problem, Ray, and I don't want to make this too crazy technical. Here's the problem you've got. You do not have the right to have an effective lawyer under the Constitution in the appellate and in the post-conviction writ process. Let me explain that. When there's a death penalty case, the first appeal is called a direct appeal. You have the right to an effective lawyer at trial, and you have the right to an effective lawyer on direct appeal. The Constitution guarantees that. But since what they call collateral appeals, which we talk about the writ system, when you start filing writs, they say the Constitution doesn't guarantee you an effective lawyer at that point, because that's a statutory right, not a constitutional right. That's the subtle distinction they made.
That sounds very subtle to me.
It's extremely subtle. But let me tell you what happened. There's a case.
Unless you're the one getting executed.
Well, it's stupid. But they're simply saying you have a right to effective lawyer at trial, effective lawyer on direct appeal. But when you file these post-conviction writs, you cannot attack your lawyer for being ineffective and not doing the right writ. Now, what happened, there's a case called Martinez versus Arizona that came out about 6 months ago. And in that case, they permitted Martinez to attack his writ lawyer as being ineffective. But the reason they did it, because in Arizona, you can only bring up ineffective points during a writ. You can't do it on direct appeal. The Supreme Court said that's not applicable to Texas, because you can bring up ineffectiveness on direct appeal. Real subtle and real nutty. But basically what it amounts to, if you have a writ lawyer that doesn't do his job, you're SOL in Texas, because you can't later go into court and saying, well, my writ lawyer was ineffective. Well, the time to bring up this Penry issue would be through a writ.
Jim, was the Penry issue solid established law when this trial took place?
Yes. In fact, the case after Penry is called Wiggins. They now call it a Wiggins case. Sure, it was established law.
And so this was the whole thing in that regard. There was some confusion about his being mentally retarded, but he tested.
Well, there was no confusion, truthfully, Ray. What they did, and let me explain how it worked. They first filed, they did a direct appeal that was affirmed. Then they did a post-conviction writ, second writ, unless there's been a change in the law. Well, the change in the law was the Atkins case, when Atkins said you can't execute mentally retarded people. Yeah. Well, everybody, once that came out, all of a sudden became
mentally retarded. That suddenly was vogue.
Everybody's stupid at this point. So what they did, they go back into court on a subsequent writ saying he's mentally retarded. The problem is, to be mentally retarded under the law, you got to have three things that happen. Number one, you got to have a sub-level IQ. The cutoff point is 70. If it's above 70, tough luck. Number two, you got to have lack of adaptive skills, meaning you can't flip a hamburger at Wendy's. You can't tie your shoes. Number three, all of these problems have got to occur before you're 18.
Mm-hmm.
The big problem with his issue on Atkins being retarded, he scored high on his IQs.
Yeah.
He did a 74, did some more. He tested up to 85, 87, and 90 on his IQs. Mm-hmm. So that knocked out the first leg. Now, what they argued, well, we can substitute what we call other procedures to overcome the fact that he scored high on his IQ. Court of Criminal Appeals flushed that, saying, no, it's got to have all three. You got to have an IQ of 70 or below. You got to have lack of adaptive skills, and it's got to occur before the age of 18. In this case, they lost it because there was never realistically a claim under Atkins, because they never could get over the IQ hump.
Well, I have to point out that by this time we would normally have heard from Gloria. I see that there's an attempt to reach her on the phone line. The change from three to one drug may be delaying the death. That's pure speculation.
Do you think, Jim, if Mazzeri was shot at the car wash and not abducted, do you think that might have changed things? Or do you think that he was abducted and taken away?
Other than the dramatic effect of that before a jury.
Do you think that would make any...
Only thing is, if you're going to... the idea you're scared to death during that period of time, and the victim is scared to death during that period of time. But I don't think it'd make any difference. I think in that climate in Dallas at that time of year, because really the ones that determine the death sentence are your prosecutors are.
Yeah.
And I think with that climate at that time, you have a black-on-white crime. You have some young black teenagers armed with scary weapons, as Ray mentioned, running around looking for somebody to rob. I don't think they'd shot him in the middle of Love Field. I don't think it made any difference, truthfully.
Larry,
but
what do you think?
But you may be right.
What do you think? Suppose they hadn't abducted him. Suppose they just shot him there and took his car.
I don't think, under this set of circumstances, I don't think it would have made much difference at all. The thing that I'm focused on now as I look at the case, that it seems as though, when we're talking about the Atkins-Penry issues,
yeah,
it seems almost as though on the writ process, they were trying to raise Penry-type issues in an Atkins writ. The kind of evidence that seemed to be trying to raise in Atkins, but under Atkins, would have been Penry-type in terms of mental retardation.
That's pretty heavy.
The big problem, Larry, is what that wonderful word called procedural default that you hear so often. Let me explain what procedural default means. His first claim on being ineffective, after he was convicted, he filed a motion for a new trial. He said his appointed lawyer was not certified to try death penalty cases. What the Court of Appeals said? You procedurally defaulted. Why? Because you didn't raise the objection at the trial court where the trial court could have corrected the problem. That's called procedural default. Next thing, on direct appeal, they did not argue any Penry issues
right
at all, and didn't argue any Atkins issue. Atkins had not come out.
Right.
Penry did. But they still didn't bring up any effectiveness based upon Penry. Now, what happened when Atkins came out, they filed a second writ. Well, they filed one writ, never brought it up in that second writ, or the first writ. Filed a second writ under Atkins, never brought it up. Remember how it works. If you don't litigate that issue at state court, you procedurally defaulted from bringing it up in federal court. Because remember, when you go to federal court, they don't review everything. They simply look at what was done at the state level and ask this question. Did what the state courts do, does it follow well-established Supreme Court law? And if you don't argue it at the state level, you cannot bring it up in federal court, with that one exception. That Martinez case is the only exception to that rule, and it's not applied to Texas. And they said the same thing today in the Supreme Court. Procedural default. He didn't bring up his Penry issue in the writs, therefore he procedurally defaulted and was barred from doing it. Because that remedy was available when he filed his first two writs. Didn't bring it up. If you don't bring it up, you're procedurally defaulted, and under current law, you can't attack your writ lawyer as being effective in Texas.
But the Atkins case being decided got him at least a stay.
It got him a stay, because that got him a stay, but they didn't do much. They didn't. All they simply did. The real problem with the Atkins case was his high IQ.
Right.
That was doomed to begin with.
Yeah, that was doomed to begin with.
It never had a prayer. All it did was get a stay. Does that jumble it up too much?
Well, no. I think this is a very interesting discussion. I think we need to discuss things like this on this particular program with our particular audience on this program, because it speaks to the inexactitude of what's going to happen in the court and with the appeals on these kinds of cases. To recap, those of you tuned in late, the lawyers agree that if this case were to happen today, it probably would not be even filed as a capital case.
It'd be filed as capital, probably waiving the death penalty. They could do that.
Yeah, but they wouldn't put a kind of energy on it, and Yocumon probably wouldn't. That it was a capital case at that time was that you were in a political gestalt such as Dallas, racially race on race based crime. Scary guns, and the dramatic nature of the crime itself would have had some influence on the jury.
I also think that the Missouri being abducted, driven away, let's put it this way, I think that increased the chances.
Well, it certainly gave the DA something dramatic to talk about.
And if he had been robbed and shot very quickly at the car wash, perhaps it still would have been filed as a death penalty case. I think it would have been filed that way, but I'm not sure. I think the abduction increased the likelihood of him being convicted on a death penalty case.
And there were other factors, too. I mean, I think the bragging about it probably was one of the worst things,
too. Pop off, you dumb with somebody. doesn't look good.
If you've got a phrase for it, that's scary. I need to remind the audience that it is now 6:32, and normally, when these procedures go by, the coming out of the death chamber and crossing the road back to the witness holding area usually takes about 20 to 25 minutes. So we're almost 10 minutes late. And the only thing that is different in this case from the previous cases is that they changed the protocol of the execution drugs.
And that surprised me, Ray, because I would have expected some writ being filed to see whether or not that's cruel and unusual.
I had to assume that somebody did.
Not at all. Wasn't even mentioned. In fact, I just read the Supreme Court decision. Elizabeth pulled it up for me just before we got on the air. And it wasn't even mentioned. The only thing mentioned this last writ was ineffectiveness for not submitting mitigating issues.
So you've actually looked at that material.
Oh, yeah, I just looked at it before we got on the air.
And this issue of changing the protocol.
Never mentioned.
Which is apparently an administrative decision within Texas Department of Criminal Justice and not something that is done by any legislative body.
You're absolutely right. Wasn't even mentioned. I expected when I knew the Supreme Court was considering something, I didn't know what. The first thing came to my mind, they're going to complain about the protocol changing. I was shocked when I read the opinion, all it dealt with was lack of the lawyer being ineffective for not presenting mitigating evidence at trial, which I was floored when I read it. Not one word said about the change of protocol.
And it seems like this issue was raised in another case earlier about the unavailability of the drug that was used.
This is the first one.
On this one.
But not in this state. This is the first one in this state.
On the one drug. But the drug that had been used before, there were some efforts to try to make those drugs unavailable. And that caused a stay of execution, I thought, a few months ago.
I don't recall that. You could be wrong.
I do recall a previous case dealing with another state, because I kind of keep my finger on the pulse of these things as they happen on a national level, because I'm into all of those mailing lists and I get all that information. We're at a loss. We've got an interview on standby But I'm reluctant to proceed until we get word from Huntsville about the witnesses cross. How this happens, for those of you who are not regular listeners to Execution Watch, the first thing we do when we come in the room is we seek a reporter in Huntsville who gives us two pieces of information. The media has crossed the road, and then the witnesses for the defendant, those that the person being executed has invited to their execution, which usually includes like a spiritual advisor and their family. And so the first thing we hear is that the witnesses, both the media and the family witnesses, have crossed the road. That meant that they went from the holding area in the old administration building across 11th Street into the death house, in the walls and into the death house. And then the next thing that happens there is the witnesses come out and cross the road going the other direction to disperse from the old administration building. That normally would happen 20 minutes after the beginning of the show. I have gone on this show. Sometimes we don't get on, so we're going to talk to Gloria or get word from Gloria whenever Gloria comes across. Meanwhile, we're going to proceed with the interview with Raymond Bonner. I need to tell you that Raymond Bonner took a South Carolina case and picked it to pieces. It's called Anatomy of Injustice. The book reads almost like a novel. It is a page-turner. His sister, Helen Prejean, one of the folks who read and reviewed the book on the back, suggested, don't pick this up if you're planning on doing anything soon, because you're not going to be able to get away from this book. Now, let me see. We're waiting on Elizabeth to get off the phone with Mr. Bonner, and we're going to put him on the air. Is he on, Mr. Bonner?
I'm here.
Are you there? I've been talking about your book, and I want you.
Thank you, Ray. I've heard you.
I want you to know that was it was quite a read for me, and I should have read Helen's words first. Of course, Sister Helen is a friend of the program and a friend of the station. If I'd have done that, I wouldn't have missed three appointments. Now tell us about yourself. You have had legal training?
Yes, I was a lawyer. I worked in various capacities as a lawyer. I suppose some people would say I couldn't hold a job. I worked for Ralph Nader when he was a good guy, some would say. And as Molly Ivins, the great Molly Ivins said, vote for Nader if you can, vote for Gore if you have to. and then I worked for Consumers Union. I taught law school. I did all kinds of things. I became a journalist.
Well, did you ever do any prosecuting?
I did, actually.
Good.
I was a prosecutor in the San Francisco District Attorney's Office.
That's good trial training, actually.
Very good.
What prompted you to look into this particular case?
Well, Ray, it's going back even before I took this case up, what got me into the death penalty was I was in working for the New York Times, and in the 2000 presidential primary, when George Bush was candidate, your esteemed governor, he was on Tim Russert, and it was after Governor Ryan had declared the moratorium on the death penalty, you'll remember, of course.
Yes, of course.
And Tim Russert on Meet the Press said to Governor Bush, would you declare a moratorium? And Bush was unequivocal, categorical, no. No innocent person has ever been executed in Texas, and they all had a fair trial. And I said to the editors at the New York Times, boy, that's a throwing down of the gauntlet. It reminded me, if you might remember, in 1984, I think it was, when Gary Hart, the presidential Democratic primary, said, and there were rumors about his marital fidelity.
Said, follow
catch me if you can. That's how I started writing about the death penalty. I got a visa, which allowed me to go to Texas. You know, you need one to come down there.
Yep.
And then I kept writing about it and ended up hearing about this case. And this case has everything. I mean, this case, the Elmore case, has every single element in the debate about the death penalty. Race, mental retardation, bad defense lawyers. I mean, one guy was drunk during the trial. Prosecutorial misconduct writ large. I mean, you talk about your Morton case down there where the DA withheld evidence. In Elmore, they didn't withhold evidence. They manufactured evidence. I mean, it has everything. And plus, it has this extraordinary lawyer, Diana Holt, who actually went to the University of Texas Law School, whose own life story is just absolutely extraordinary.
And it was her work, as reported by you, that ultimately got this man off of death row. He wasn't found innocent. He wasn't an exoneree. But
well,
he got off death row.
Let me say something, Ray. I've looked at a lot of death penalty cases. I'm a lawyer. I'm a journalist. Edward Lee Elmore is innocent beyond innocent. It's not just that he didn't have a fair trial. He is innocent. He did not commit the crime, period, full stop.
Can you hold on just a second, Mr. Bonner? We have a report from the Walls.
Sure.
Okay, please. Gloria?
Hi, Ray.
What happened?
Well, Texas had murdered another person. The family just came out. I understand his mom and I think two aunts and two cousins witnessed the execution. There's about 5, 10, 15, 20, about 30 of us out here, including his family.
Any explanation of what taking so long? Gloria?
No, nobody knows.
Would you do us a favor and talk to the family and see what they witnessed in there?
I have a feeling the ones that witnessed are going back to the hospitality house. Dick Burr, one of the attorneys, and somebody else told me that this one drug could likely take longer. So until we actually see what the family says, I guess we won't know.
Well, we're literally 20 minutes later than the normal procedure.
Yes, we are. And so I don't know if there was a problem or he gave a long statement or what happened.
Let's see what Grazik runs tomorrow.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gloria.
Okay. All
right. Okay, love you. Sorry that we have bad news tonight. And Elizabeth, will you get in touch with will you get in touch with Jennifer and tell her that the procedure is completed? I'm sorry, Mr. Bonner, but we had to cover the news. And
do you know that the I don't know if you're aware of this, the first execution by lethal injection was in Texas in December 1982?
Yes, of course. Charlie Brooks was, we had French folks that went back and duplicated my prison show. This was before execution.
Oh, right, yeah.
Here. Went back to France and duplicated.
And you know, it's interesting, Ray, I was thinking about this and all this concern about this drug they're using now. It hasn't ever been tested. And in fact, I've been following, although it's not in my book, subsequent to the book, I've been following this whole issue of where they're going to get the drugs for the lethal injections. The company that manufactures pentobarbital, Lundbeck, in Denmark, has written a letter to Texas saying, don't use our drugs in lethal injections. In execution.
But that doesn't have any force in law. That's just a recommendation
of
the supplier.
And, you know, it's inhumane, you'd say. I mean, it takes them longer to kill. But listen to what some witness said at the Charlie Brooks execution. It's too lenient.
Ooh.
They've got to go painfully.
Well, I believe that that is actually a thought in Texas on a regular basis.
I do too. That's why I read it.
We are talking on
I don't
execution
think it's in Texas everywhere. I don't think they're in Massachusetts much different than we are, right?
Really?
Thank
the
you.
Witch?
I said I.
But
think.
Jim is in the Jim Skelton is our legal advisor here, a trained attorney who covers. What happens and what happens in the trial and
oh,
appeals.
I don't think it's different than, no, Texas or any other state that has it. No, you're absolutely
I
right.
Think that the most bloodthirsty people on the planet are those pro-execution people.
Are Bible Belt people.
Bible
That's
Belt.
That's the crazy
execution.
Thing. It's always in the Bible Belt. It's the Christians that kill.
Yeah.
That's what's nutty.
Yeah. Well, we're interviewing Raymond Bonner, who calls from London. His book, Anatomy of Injustice, is about a South Carolina case. What is there a standard of law that is appropriate for executions in your mind, Mr. Bonner?
I'll tell you where I come out at the end of the day on all this, and it's what the Wisconsin District Attorney said when I interviewed him. And you might remember the case of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Of course.
The serial killer who dismembered at least 17 boys.
Of course.
You know, cut them up, carved them up, flushed them down the toilet, etc. And the Wisconsin District Attorney, Ray, who prosecuted him. We're not talking about some lily-livered left-wing civil liberties liberal like myself. We're talking about the Wisconsin District Attorney. After all that, said he was still opposed to capital punishment. And here's what he said. I have a gut suspicion of the state wielding the power of death over anybody. To participate in the killing of another human being, it diminishes the respect for life, period. And that's where I come out.
Well, you can understand all of that in both liberal progressive standpoint, or you could understand that in libertarian standpoint.
Exactly.
I think that a certain amount of being suspicious of the government having awesome power is a pretty spooky idea.
I totally agree with you.
We've been talking to Raymond Bonner, his book, Anatomy of Injustice, A Murder Case Gone Wrong. And I gather from the interview, he suspects a lot of murder cases, not indeed most of them go wrong. And he is suspicious of any standard of law that would give government that kind of power. You're our kind of guy, Mr. Bonner. If you're ever over in Houston, drop by and we'll coffee up.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And I'm sorry to be interviewed on such an occasion.
It makes the show complete. Thank you, sir.
Oh, thank you.
Well, interesting fellow. Interesting book.
Go ahead, Susan.
I would point out that the two other individuals that were involved in this each got a 10-year sentence. So if they did, probably they did, they would have to do 5 years on the 10-year sentence. Probably didn't do more than 8. So those two individuals have been out of prison for quite a while.
Yeah, but you know there is something. I don't know about all this law parties. I know Jim's got the standard rubber stamp answer to this, that if it weren't for the law parties, what the hell are we doing locking up Charles Manson? Isn't that your line?
Well, Ray, everybody has the law of parties. What it basically is, it's real simple. If you help someone commit a crime, you're as guilty as a person that committed
it. Yeah, but I believe if you're along for the ride, if you're just there.
Being there, you wouldn't be a party. You got to do some act to assist or help.
Okay, so what you're telling me is they had to present some kind of evidence. Well, these people probably pled out.
Right. After his tried first, he pled out.
He tried first, right. And everybody else pled out after.
It wasn't a plea deal where they had to testify against him.
Yeah.
Presumably, their testimony at trial.
They didn't testify at trial.
Oh, they didn't testify. No. Okay. Well, 10 years, I think, was probably a very favorable plea for both of them.
They had better lawyers. They had Susan Anthony quality lawyers.
Well, but it was a fairly favorable plea, wouldn't you say?
All of it came after he was tried first.
And it's also prosecutorial discretion again. I mean, the prosecutor decided, I'm going to give them a deal, and they can do that. Or I'm going to go after you, and he can do that, too.
Now, see, this case illustrates what Scott Turow said. I think Scott Turow, I think is how you pronounce his name, the writer that used to be a prosecutor. He was the one that headed the commission in Illinois when the governor abolished the death penalty.
I met him.
And here's what he said. He said at the very beginning of his study that he was in favor of the death penalty. In fact, he took a vote, and a majority of people on that commission were in favor of the death penalty. Afterwards, he was opposed to it. And why? He was opposed to it. Here's what he said. It's not that people have not committed horrible, heinous acts. Terrible. He said, you can't argue that. But we simply can't do it right. Because in this case, you've got four people. Two people did the shooting. One gets death, one gets life. The other two gets 10 years in the penitentiary. Too much prosecutorial discretion. We simply don't do it right. For example, a woman is more likely to not get the death penalty than a man. As I've often said before, if Andrea Yates' name was Andy, he'd be dead now. They would have executed him in 2 seconds. You have the greater possibility of getting death penalty in Texas than you would in California or other states. We just simply can't do it right as society. And that was his argument against it. I think it made a lot of good sense.
Well, and Ohio isn't Illinois is where the stack that killed all those nurses.
Right.
He died in prison, but not from execution.
I'm not sure they had the death penalty in effect. Was that before Furman versus Georgia was in effect?
It was after Furman. So he was not subject to that.
Same thing with David Brooks and Emmeline Henley, by the way.
Yeah.
They came in under the
interim period.
Right.
And Jeffrey Dahmer was killed by another inmate, actually.
Right.
He wasn't executed in that case.
Did he get the death penalty?
No.
I didn't think so.
No, he was in general population, therefore he got killed. You wouldn't have gotten killed if you were in death penalty.
Was he a pre-Furman during the Furman versus Georgia era when they didn't have
it? He just, some reason or other, I don't think so, because that's relatively recent, all those Dahmer killings. As well after Texas started executing people. I don't know what the legal situation was in his state.
But from listening to Mr. Bonner, I assume that he got the death sentence. Maybe it was commuted or something. I don't have any idea, but I know he was killed by another inmate.
Yeah, he was killed by another inmate. You have been listening to the Execution Watch on KPFT. We do another show called Prison Watch, which is on Friday nights, and one of the co-hosts of that show is Anthony Graves, who is an exoneree. Anthony was convicted in a murder that he did not do, and he served 17 years on Texas death row, and then he got off of death row and was in general population, and so he wound up doing a total of 18 and a half years in Texas prison system for a crime that he did not commit. He has now been completely exonerated for actual innocence. The state has paid him money for his wrongful conviction. Of course, I don't think there's enough money for that. And he is now part-time occupied as a co-host on KPFT's The Prison Show. We have, Wisconsin does not have the death penalty.
That's the reason.
That's the reason he was. And so we are in our 33rd year of producing The Prison Show, and we're on every Friday night. A lot of the fellows that are listening to this show right now, because we're at KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, 89.7 in Huntsville, and more importantly, 90.3 in Goodrich, Livingston, where Death Row is located. I will be visiting Death Row next Wednesday. I'm going to do an interview with Sarge Foster again. Sarge had a previous date. We did an interview, and when Sarge Execution Watch comes up, which we hope will happen never, the interview part of that show will be with Sarge himself. I tell you fellas that are listening up there, no matter what your persuasion is, you've heard tonight's show, you know we had an interview. If you have a date and wish to be interviewed, for your execution date, give us a kite and we will make those arrangements. Ask around the row. Our number is easy to find, and Gloria is there frequently. We don't like doing this show. The best thing in the world that could have happened is that somebody could have raised the issue of that single drug, and we're very interested. That's the pending business. I'm very interested in what caused the delay. If the delay winds up with somebody on that gurney suffering for a longer period of time than necessary, the witnesses would have been able to perceive that. And if the witnesses perceive that, alert goes out to all attorneys representing the last appeal to people on death row. That is an issue that needs to be more fully plumbed. I don't think that an administrative decision of a prison system should be left solely to deal with what chemistry is used in an execution. I think that needs a broader discussion. Susan, don't you think so?
Perhaps. I mean, I just don't know. You said that they use it to put animals down.
But I don't want Fido to suffer either.
No, I certainly don't want. I mean, I love dogs, and I don't want any dogs.
Yeah, we have gone through hanging in this country and electric chairs and lethal injections, and of course, California had the gas chamber for virtually ever. And each of these things, ways of executing people, I don't think we've used the guillotine on this side of the Atlantic that I know of.
Well, if we have a little moment, let me tell you about something today that I found, a case we just covered today, that it's a death penalty, another case. It's just, I find highly offensive, the death penalty case. What happened is that a typical death penalty case in which a penury issue was brought up later, and the Fifth Circuit kicked it back to our courts, to Susan Brown, to hold a hearing on the penury issue. Mm-hmm. Not penury, I apologize, the Atkins issue and the guy being retarded. So what happened, they had 7 days of evidence on whether or not he was retarded or not. The guy's name was, I think it was Coulter, I've forgotten the guy's name. Anyway, they had a 7-day hearing, and at the very end of the hearing, Susan Brown, the district court judge.
We gotta go.
Okay, I'll talk about it later.
Turn it over to Elizabeth.